Okay, hello. So let's get started. So my name is Jerry Kudusewski. I'm a prof in biology, and I work on C. elegans, so like this model organism. I'm not sure, have you guys taken much of C. elegans in this course yet or anything at all? Yes, no, a little bit? A little bit? Okay, so well, you know, I'm going to do a little bit of an intro and then get into a bit about the topics of apoptosis, because that's a C. elegans turned out to be a really good model organism for studying apoptosis. So, and then I'll get into a little bit about apoptosis in mammalian systems, and that's pretty well the layout of this talk for today. Okay, so C. elegans as a model organism. So I'm pretty sure you're going to get these slides later, but you know, feel free to copy them down if you so want. So the deal with C. elegans is that it's very small, quite easy to culture. So like when I talk about small, they're about 1 millimeter in size. I brought a couple plates here. Unfortunately, like I kind of screwed up splitting them yesterday, but if you want to pass this around, you kind of look it up in the light, you'll see them. Like they are visible to the naked eye, just about 1 millimeter in length. And in this plate, I might have like a couple dozen or so. If you just look around, I kind of think, so what they're doing is they're growing on this agar, and then in the middle of the agar, there's a lawn of bacteria, so that serves as their food. And then on their lawn of bacteria, I have another little small slab of agar, and that's just how I transfer it from an old plate to a new plate, just to let them grow. So essentially, that's what you're looking at here. They're non-parasitic, so they're not dangerous. Bacteria is not dangerous either, but it's probably most more dangerous thing of anything on that plate. But there you can take a look at it and see what it's like. Okay, so they're pretty easy to culture. I have a little bit more to say about that a little bit later. They're very resilient. So the story I give about resiliency is that, you know, I must admit, this is going back maybe over 10, 15 years ago, but there was a space shuttle, Columbia, I think. You were probably quite young at that time, but it went up and it actually exploded up in the upper atmosphere, and unfortunately all the astronauts on it perished and so forth. Quite a tragedy. But on board that space shuttle was actually a C. elegans experiment. So they had a little box and they had some worms growing on it. Couple of months later, they actually found that box with the experiment in a bog in Texas. They cracked it open, and the worms were still alive. So they were able to survive like a drop from the upper atmosphere all the way down to the Earth. So, you know, they are very, very resilient animals. You can do a lot to them, and they can still survive. So, you know, I'm sure when humans, you know, long disappear from this planet, C. elegans will still be surviving. Okay, they have quite a quick generation time. So from the point where they're fertilized to the point where they actually are laying eggs themselves is about 3.5 days. So you can go from one generation to a second generation fairly quickly. And so that's really good for genetics. You know, you can rapidly do a lot of genetics because of its quick turnover time in terms of its lifespan, generation time. Excuse me. For the most part, they're hermaphrodites. So an animal can essentially make its own egg and sperm, and they essentially self-fertilize their egg and then lay their eggs and allow it to develop. The good thing about it is that there's a small percentage of males in the population as well. So it doesn't follow like, you know, how humans or mammals follow like the XY sort of genotyping for male and female. It's actually more of a X for hermaphrodites, and then males are actually just missing the second chromosome. So it's like just one single X, and that's what gives rise to males. And so it happens to have a lot, much less occurrence. Like it's not like 50%, it's like 1 in 1,000. And it happens when there's like a chromosomal disjunction, like that you don't get proper chromosomes going where they should during meiosis. But the good thing is having males is very useful because you can actually transfer genes with it. So like, you know, you can use males, and if you have like a gene that you're interested in, you can use that to cross it from hermaphrodite to hermaphrodite. So without it, it'd be really hard to do any genetics. They're very simple. probably the, so they make up around 1,000 somatic cells. The hermaphrodites are slightly less, the males are slightly more. And it's like the simplest organism with a nervous system, for one thing. So a lot of neurobiology was done with it, so it's kind of a really good system for doing that. And let's see what else we have here. Right, oh yes, they're transparent. So you can look under them, look under a microscope, low light, and you can see, the internal tissues or the internal organs. So you can actually see every cell. If you have a high powerful enough microscope, you can look at it, and there's nothing to really block your view of what's going on. And because of that, it's also really good for use for fluorescent proteins. You can put fluorescent proteins in there and see where they're being expressed quite easily. And another thing, and I'm going to talk about this a lot more, is that they actually have an invariant cell lineage. So this is quite unique for C. elegans, much different from like humans, for example. And I'll just describe what that means and the importance for it, especially when it comes down to apoptosis. Okay, so this is like a life cycle of C. elegans. So if you start off with a fertilized egg, I just want to point out a couple things. So it goes through, you know, in hours here, so quite after, quite quickly, the number of hours at fertilization to the point where it's actually, so usually the hermaphrodite lays its eggs and then it can essentially hatch out of this egg onto the plate that we are looking at there, so it hatches. One thing I want to, so a lot of the development, like inside hermaphrodite, but then a lot of it occurs outside of it as well. And then it goes through these larval stages, like L1, L2, L3, and L4. So it kind of sheds its cuticle at each point, each branch in between here. So it hatches to L1, and then L1, L2 kind of sheds its cuticle, grows a little larger, and so forth, until it becomes L4, the last bit of shedding its last cuticle, or its molting, it's called, and it forms the adult. And then it can produce offspring itself. So one thing that makes it really resilient is that there's also, like, you know, this is quite simple, there's also a alternate life cycle. And that is, if the worm, like at the L1 stage, if it senses that, you know, there's too many worms on the plate, so overcrowding is one thing, or there's not enough food in the environment, that's another thing that triggers it, it can kind of exit this life cycle. So it kind of goes out, and it enters what we call the dower stage. So this dower, it's D-A-U-E-R. So this dower, it's a German word, and it means enduring. So essentially, they kind of exit, you know, growth, and they stop growing. They're in this dower stage, and they just essentially just bunker down and wait till more food comes along. And they can wait for months at a time. You know, so they can wait 2 or 3 months, and then some food comes to rise, and then they just kind of re-enter. They re-enter past the L3 stage and grow up, and they're essentially normal after that. So they can withstand long periods of, you know, absence of food by going through this dower or this alternate life cycle. Okay. So a lot of genetics has been done with this. Very useful genetics. You know, they did these screens and found these different phenotypes. So that's what we're talking about here, different morphological, for example, behavior, and different types of phenotypes here. And essentially, this is, you know, how they described it, for example. So some of the morphological ones, a common one they found was these dumpy worms. Essentially, you know, as you kind of see in the picture there, they kind of form nice long cylinders. The dumpy ones are not very cylindric, but they kind of look like a football. So they're you know, kind of squished and a little plump. And so the idea here is, so this is the type of the phenotype along, you know, this side here. This is how we short form for the phenotype. So dumpy is called PPY. But the important thing is here, this is the name of the genes that we apply to it. So if there's a mutation was identified that caused the dumpy phenotype, they called it, you know, lowercase DPY, and then they number it, like DPY1. So dumpy1, that was like the first gene characterized, when mutated, gave rise to a dumpy worm. And same with, like, long here, you had very extra long worms or small. Really interesting, the long and small worms turned out to be part of the TGF signaling pathway. So like studying that turned out to be very advantageous. So learning more about TGF beta signaling. I did a lot of work on here on these worms called uncoordinated. So uncoordinated worms, essentially these worms are, so C. rhodonis elegans, so that's the name, C. elegans. They are really, I think, elegant animals. And they actually move quite elegantly as well. So if you had like one worm on a plate here, if I draw it, and then it travels along, it tends to travel in a very nice sinusoidal wave. These uncoordinated animals were unable to really move appropriately in a sinusoidal wave, and often they were paralyzed. So you know, this onc is supposed to be here, that was UNC, and then you have different genes called onc genes. And then there's a couple other ones, lethal. These are mutations in here were lethal. You know, they killed the worm, they didn't really survive. And then other ones were cell lineage abnormal, or these Lin genes. So what happens with them was that some of their tissues, they were supposed to form like one type, but they actually formed a different type. So a mutation in a specific gene caused like a change in what sort of tissue that was actually formed. So those are like the cell lineage abnormal. And those turned out to be pretty cool mutations as well. Okay, and so like, you know, just get a little idea here. This is like, you know, a picture of a wild type worm, like nice little sinusoidal wave, and as it moves, you know, a little dumpy worm, but not severely dumpy, but mildly dumpy. Small worms are just smaller. So they, you know, this looks like a larval worm, but it's able to actually reproduce and give rise to eggs. And these long worms tend to be extra long as well. So just an idea of the pictures of some of these. Okay, so, you know, so that's kind of like a little background here. I really kind of bummed out. I had some movies here, but I can't show it. I was going to use my computer to plug it in here, but I can't seem to be able to plug it into this computer. So anyways, we'll just move on here. So that's a little background, and I want to talk a little bit about cell lineage and get on to our next topic here. So the thing about, so what did I say about the cell lineage of C. elegans? What was the one thing on the first slide I showed about? It's invariant. Okay, so do you have an idea what that means?
It doesn't vary.
So what doesn't vary? That's exactly it. And that occurs like right, so the cells have specific fate and occurs, you know, right at the beginning of development. Okay, so this is what goes on here. So with C. elegans, so this is looking at the oocyte here, and this is just like right after fertilization. So you have like the sperm here. So one thing that happens right upon fertilization is that the sperm actually helps determine the axis for one thing. So essentially you come up with the anterior and posterior is being established by where the sperm actually enters the oocyte. And so where the sperm enters is going to be the posterior of the animal. And so that's one thing that happens. So you establish the anterior posterior axis like right away. The second thing that happens here is as your sperm from nucleus, you know, they have to migrate towards the oocyte to join in and form your diploid genome. The thing that happens here is that, these little colors here, so for example, this color, this like orangey, you know, yellowish orange, I'm careful about colors or whatever, and these purple, these represent a couple different proteins. Even the gray represents a third protein. But what happens is that as the sperm nucleus kind of goes in, it kind of gets caught up in the cortex, like the cortical actin, and the cortical actin kind of gets bent, and then it moves as well. And it, as they come in together, and the cortical actin causes these proteins to line up in certain positions. I'm not going to go into the details of what the proteins are, but the point is that, you know, this orange one will come onto like this side on the anterior side, the purple one will stay on the posterior side, and the gray one gets pushed over to the anterior side as well. And so, you know, you get these proteins being lined in different parts of the oocyte after fertilization, and then you get cell division. And because of where these proteins are, you go through the process of asymmetric cell division. So essentially, right from the very start here, from one cell to two cell, you have two very different identities to these cells. So we create essentially what we call, in Zeller's field, the AB cell, and the other one's called the P1 cell. But they're different. They're fated different, and they will become different types of cells. So this is unlike, you know, in humans where you have a lot of, you know, especially in early cell division, the cells are essentially identical and they're kind of randomly mixed up, and you can switch them around and you can still come up with a viable fetus. Well, in this case, you're going to have the cells going to be split up in this way, in C. elegans. Okay, so you get asymmetric cell division. And so this is, you know, how you can follow it for a little bit. So this is like looking at like the two cell stage. This is when the two cell stage starts to divide, form your four cell stage, and so forth until you get dozens if not hundreds of cells. And so what people did like in 1960s, 1970s, what they did was they tried to follow each of these cells. So they essentially tried to, you know, determine what was going on here. So because of the invariant cell lineage, they can look at all these different worms and find out that they form the same sorts of cells at the same time in a very, you know, a very precise manner. And so every cell was followed and it was mapped. And it was mapped to determine what their, you know, subsequent offsprings would generate. So, you know, this took a fair bit of work. You know, this is like, you know, grad students sitting on a microscope and, you know, watching this and drawing what's happening in the 60s and 70s for over like 17, 18, over a day at a time to find out. One thing they could do is they could stop this experiment by just like putting these worms at 4 degrees. They just put it in the fridge. And the good thing is like the development like stopped cold, like, you know, if I could say cold, it stopped at that point, and then they could go for a bathroom break for whatever they needed, come back and then watch and put it back at room temperature and follow the development as it went on. So, you know, it's a lot of work, but they were able to do it. And they came up with this sort of cell lineage. So, you know, this is starting off with the fertilized egg here, and you kind of split off into two cells. You've got the AB and P1 cells we kind of saw before. And then you go through the subsequent, you know, cell divisions. And you can see that they form like different tissues. Like for example here, the AB1 give rise to part of the pharynx, as well as the hyperdermis. Hyperdermis is essentially the outer, like the skin layer of the animal, and some neurons as well. So you know that AB cells will always form these types. And for example, you form like, you know, the 8-cell stage, this MS cell. This MS cell would be the precursor for all the muscle cells, for example. So that's how they did that. And so they were able to do all this, find out, you know, which cell gave rise to all these different tissues. And as you can imagine, for like 1,000, like you get up to about 1,000 cells, this is, you know, a fair bit of work. And this is like just looking at like one little branch. And, you know, they kind of, you follow them here, left, right kind of thing, and they come up with different, you know, this is the name of the final cell at this point, you know, until it becomes like the adult. And, you know, they mapped every cell and found out where it came from. And then they also noticed, you know, you see these little X's. Like, what happened, you think, there? What happened to those cells? It's kind of like the topic of today's lecture. Yeah?
Apoptosis.
So the thing is, they found that, you know, this cell would always die. Like, you know, it was like programmed to die. Like, it wasn't, you know, a random sort of event. Every time during development, this, you know, these cells would divide, get to this point, and then this cell would undergo apoptosis. Always, because it's invariant. And same with this one. And you know, they could time it. They knew when it was going to happen. They knew what cells were going to happen to. And they found out these cells dying. And so this is gave them the idea of apoptosis. Okay. Right. So this is, you know, the beginning of how apoptosis was discovered. They found that due to the invariant cell lineage, that these specific cells would die at certain times during development. So they called apoptosis, this is programmed cell death, okay? So this was something that was inherent to the development of the animal. Your makeup, your genetic makeup was programmed for it to kill these cells at specific times. And it's determined by the invariant somatic cells, and they knew exactly which cells were going to go up apoptosis, where and when they will die. Okay. So that's the first discovery of apoptosis in anywhere was in C. elegans. Okay. So we can give you a little bit of, you know, facts about apoptosis here. So with apoptosis, so as I mentioned, there's around 1,000. For hermaphrodites, around 900. So the true number is 959 somatic cells. At the end, during development, actually 131 of them actually go through apoptosis. So it's a significant number. At least 1 in 8 of these cells actually undergo apoptosis. And I think it's important to know that apoptosis here, this is, you know, to be clear, this is a programmed cell death. And so this is different, like a different sort of thing from death of pathological damage, for example. Like, you know, if you actually try to add an insult to a cell and killing it, that sort of cell death is referred to as necrosis. So like there's a totally different type of cell death. There's two differences. One's called necrosis, and the other one's called apoptosis. Apoptosis deals with the programmed cell death from within our development. Okay. Yep?
So can you explain again why it's not necrosis versus apoptosis?
Yeah, so they're different mechanisms, but with apoptosis, it's like inherent to that cell's fate. You know, so that fate is one, that fate of that cell, when it comes to that point in that fate of that cell, when it comes to that point in development, is fated to die. So it's inherent within that cell due to, you know, whatever genetic makeup it has to kill itself or to die.
And the process is like you make it die?
Yeah, exactly. So some people, so this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, but some people like would treat cells with hydrogen peroxide, for example. And that's like an insult to the cell, and the cells would die, and they call that apoptosis. Like, you know, that the peroxide made them, you know, undergo apoptosis. But that's not programmed cell death, as far as, yeah, I don't think it is. And, you know, you're going to have some people that would argue it is, but I think it's a totally different mechanism. Okay, so programmed cell death is apoptosis. Okay, all right, so this is looking at an embryo, and the thing about it, I want to kind of give you an idea of why, so, you know, following the cell lineage, people can find that these cells died, and this is, you know, one good thing about it. So this is looking at an embryo, there's like hundreds of cells at this point, so it's kind of like later in development. And you can see where these arrows are pointed to. You have like these kind of really different sort of looking cells. They're kind of like, they call like a buttoned up cells. So the thing is, they had a different sort of morphology, a different sort of reactivity. So you can look under the microscope and you can see them crop up. And so you can, you know, quite easily count them during development and see how many you had at any time during development. And so that's what really made it, so, you know, the fact that there's invariant cell lineage and that you can observe these cells in C. elegans made it really advantageous to use C. elegans to study apoptosis. Okay. And, you know, C. elegans is, you know, I think with Drosophila, probably one of the best sort of animals to do genetic studies. And so They had this phenotype, like apoptotic cells. They wanted to kind of figure out the mechanism for how this was done. So they tried to use genetics to figure out, you know, what genes are involved with and important. So they did genetics to the rescue. And so a third point with C. elegans that turns out to be quite useful. So the first one was invariant cell lineage. The second one is the fact that you can see the refractivity of those dying cells made it really easy to detect. The third one is that apoptosis, in the end, turned out to not be essential for viability. So you could prevent apoptosis from occurring, and these animals were still alive. And that made it much easier to do genetics. And it kind of also leaves open the question of why is there apoptosis at all? You know, does it give like any benefit to the animal? And really, we don't know the answer to that. At least, you know, when you culture them in the lab, you know, there's no inherent advantages to having apoptosis, but maybe when they're in the wild, there's some sort of advantage for having apoptosis, and that's why it occurs. But good for us, apoptosis is not essential. And so they did what we call forward genetics. So, you know, when we do genetics, we can do what we call either forward genetics or reverse genetics. Does anybody, have you taken up or you have an idea what forward genetics is? What is forward genetics? Do you have an idea what I'm talking about? Yes? You know, yeah, go ahead.
Is that when you induce a mutation and look for the phenotype afterwards?
That's kind of close. You create random mutations, right? You create random mutations, so you randomly, you know, generate mutants, and you look for a phenotype of interest. Okay, so you know, that's a good description. I think the idea is reverse genetics is like you have a specific gene you're interested in, you knock it out, and you find out, you know, what does that cause, what phenotype that cause. This is like you randomly create these mutations, find one that creates the phenotype you're interested in, like so if you're looking at, you know, any changes in apoptosis, for example, and then you work back and you identify the gene. So that's what forward genetics is. So you work back, you randomly create mutations, work back and identify where that mutation is, identify the gene that causes that phenotype. Okay. All right, so this is how mutagenesis of C. elegans works. So this is like a forward sort of genetics. So remember, these animals are hermaphrodites, so they make their own egg and sperm. And you just treat these hermaphrodites with some sort of mutagen. So there's two ways to do it. Sometimes you use a chemical, this EMS, which is kind of like a gentle way to make point mutations, for example. Or we can be a little bit stronger and use these physical methods like gamma rays. These cause like breaks, double-stranded breaks and deletions, like large deletions in the genome. So there's two ways to do this, gently or, you know, more harsh. And you hope it occurs in the germline, like either in the eggs or the sperm. You get them to fertilize in your hermaphrodite. And at the F1 stage, you have, for the most part, you'll have a heterozygous mutation. And you let this heterozygote self-fertilize as well. So you let this animal self-fertilize, and then it'll come up with these different, you know, follow Mendelian genetics and find these different possibilities. So in the F2, you're going to get like 1/4 of the animals would be, you know, wild type genetically, homozygous wild type. Half of them would be heterozygous for the mutation. Well, half of them, another quarter would be genetically mutant, homozygous mutant. And you would hope, so on the F2, hopefully these would have your phenotype that you're looking for. I call that phenotype large M for the mutation is just a small. So like this, you know, this is assuming if this is like a recessive mutation, for example, you know, you have to get like two, a homozygous mutant to actually see a phenotype. If you have like a gain of function or you know, a dominant sort of phenotype, you may actually see a phenotype in the F1. So anyways, you can carry out these mutations. And so this is what they kind of did for, you know, monitoring apoptosis. And so they did just genetics. So this is like looking at, you know, your embryo develops, those red dots just represent the apoptotic cells. And the idea is that the number of apoptotic cells that are occurring. And like this is supposed to be, you know, considered like a normal number, for example. And so when they did these things, so they're essentially, you know, looking at apoptosis, looking for either increase in the number of apoptosis or decrease in the number of apoptotic cells. And they identify these different genes that mutations in them cause this phenotype. They call this phenotype SED, so CED, or cell death defective. You know, somehow they had a defect in apoptosis. And they identified a large number of them. One gene that they identified was called SED9. That's this gene here. And SED9, different types of mutations did a couple things. First of all, the loss of function SED9 here, so that's what this picture is going to show. The loss of function SED9 actually gave rise to excess number of cell death. Okay, so in the absence, so in a mutation of SED9, this loss of function SED9, you actually got increased number of apoptotic cells. And they also found, you know, other mutations within SED9, and these ones were actually gain of function. So SED9 was actually active for whatever reason. It wasn't really being regulated, it's always being turned on. So that's what these gain of function mutations are like. And in that case, worms with this mutation, this gain of function, would have a reduced number of apoptosis. But cells that would normally die would survive. So the number of apoptotic cells decreased. Okay. So what's it saying about the function of SED9? So what's SED9 doing? SED9 is, what's it doing to apoptosis? Promoting it or inhibiting it? Yeah, go ahead. Exactly, so SED9, its main function, you know, when they look at this, its main function is to inhibit apoptosis. All right, so, you know, kind of see those things there. So SED9, one important gene, you know, we'll come back to that a little bit again. And they found out a couple more genes, SED3 or SED4. So these are specific genes that are mutated. So when you have loss of function of each of them, you kind of get a different phenotype. So the SED3 or SED4 mutant, you actually had an absence of any apoptosis. So if you remove SED3, you're missing apoptosis, okay? And if you remove SED4, so you have loss of function SED4, you're missing apoptosis. So what does this mean? So what's the function of SED3 and SED4? So if you're missing them, you don't have any apoptosis, so the main role is to promote apoptosis. So SED3 and SED4 are important for apoptosis. So apoptosis requires a functional SED3 or a functional SED4. Yeah?
Do you need removal of both SED3 and 4?
Okay, that's a good question. So it's either one. So if you have a mutation in SED3, you do not have apoptosis. Mutation SED4, you did not. You don't need mutation in both. Okay, and then with C. elegans, you can do these genetics. You know, this is what I'm talking about. You can create like double mutants, and remember, so you can create like double mutants of you know, opposing phenotypes and see which one is the, you know, the dominant sort of phenotype when you make the doubles. So in this case, what they did was they made a double mutant. So they take a strain that has a mutation in SED3. And a mutation in SED9. So remember, the mutation in SED9, this actually promotes apoptosis, while SED3 mutation set 3 inhibits apoptosis from occurring. But when you put them both together, it seems like the set 3 is like the dominant phenotype. You know, you don't see the set 9 phenotype, you see the set 3 phenotype. So this is an important piece of information. It actually tells us that set 3 is what we call epistatic to set 9. So set 3 is epistatic to set 9. So that is kind of like the dominant phenotype you see. And it kind of gives an indication that if you're thinking about pathways, and that's what we're trying to do here, your set 3 is probably downstream of set 9. So your set 9 requires set 3 to actually carry out its function. And so they came up with this pathway. So how it works is set three promotes apoptosis, so that's what it's doing. Set 4, they kind of worked out the signaling pathway. Set 4 is just upstream of set 3 and activates it to promote apoptosis, while set 9 inhibits this process. So the whole point of set 9 is to inhibit set 3 from activating the role of set 9 is to inhibit set 4 from activating set 3 and promoting apoptosis. Okay. So, you know, doing these genetics, you can find this sort of stuff out. So it turns out, so set 3 and set 4, they're central for apoptosis, right? And cells that do not undergo apoptosis have set 3 and set 4 turned off by set 9. So that's how things work. So they can actually identify what these proteins are. So set 4, so when we actually talk about the protein, we put these, you know, we use lowercase for genes. When you talk about proteins, we put uppercases. So that's why it's called capital C, capital E, capital D, dash 4. We're referring to the protein. Set 4 is actually a protease activating factor. And its whole role is to activate set 3. And set 3 itself is a protease. So it degrades proteins, and as it degrades proteins, it initiates cell death. And as I mentioned, set 9 binds to and inactivates set 4. That's how that whole system works. And there are homologs to these, and I'm going to come back at the end of this lecture to talk about the mammalian homologs to these three genes in humans. Okay, there's one more gene I want to talk about, and kind of how it was discovered, I think, was kind of neat. Okay, so this is like looking at the top. This is like a normal worm, okay? This is a mutant worm at the bottom. This is like its head here. Right here, this is where the eggs get laid. So it has like two arms where it can make its eggs. So this is where eggs are being made here, goes through here. This is where it gets fertilized, for example, and comes here, and that's where the eggs are laid. Same with here, it comes down here, the eggs are being formed, kind of goes through this little area here, and then they become laid. So that's how they're like the oocyte is being generated here and here and so forth. And then they're laid. Okay. Any idea what you're looking at here? Kind of is a bit confusing. So what do you think? So that's a worm. What do you think is going on with that worm? Any idea? So what do you think these little lines are? Yeah?
It's babies.
Exactly, larval worms. So this is a mutants of these worms can't actually lay their eggs. So their muscles aren't working properly to lay their eggs. And so what happens is that, you know, these eggs get formed, they get fertilized, they can't be laid, and they hatch inside the hermaphrodite. And they keep hatching and hatching until like there's, you know, dozens of these worms. Like so one C. elegans worm can make over like 300 offspring. So you can get like a large number of these worms, and they can't get out. So they essentially start eating the inside of the worm. And they eat to the point where they burst through, like they kill the hermaphrodite, for example, and they get through the hypodermis or the outer layer, and they go off, and they can go, you know, live, and essentially the same thing will happen to them as well because they have this mutation. Okay, so this is like a really a striking phenotype. Like, you know, look at these worms on the plate. You know, it's going, wow, this is, you know, really stands out. And so this is a very specific type of phenotype, and it's called the bag of worms phenotype. So it essentially looked like a bag of worms before they all eat through the hermaphrodite and go into the rest of the plate. And their mutation, so their bag of worms phenotype is due to this specific neuron. And this neuron is called the hermaphrodite specific neuron. So it's a neuron specific for hermaphrodites. You actually do not see it in males. But in hermaphrodites, it's important for allowing the eggs to lay. So it kind of innervates the vulva and allows the eggs to be laid. So without this neuron, they can't lay their eggs. So it, in males, it undergoes apoptosis. In a normal hermaphrodite, it does not. But in these mutants, it does. So it's kind of really neat that it has like a sex-specific apoptosis going on here during development. Okay, so the mutation was, you know, characterized, and they found that the gene responsible is called EGL1, EGL1. It's actually a gain-of-function mutation that causes it. So EGL1, gain-of-function hermaphrodites, they have this phenotype. And with it, and it turns out these EGL1 mutants were really useful, and they did different set of screens with these. They did what we call suppression screens. So essentially, like I said, like all of these animals would go through like the same sort of, you know, effect that its mother would. Like they would grow up and they would have these bag of worms phenotypes. A suppression screen, what they do is they take these animals and mutate them. And the idea is to mutate it so that they prevent that phenotype from occurring. So they kind of suppress it, so they suppress the phenotype and try to create like normal worms back again. So they do their mutations, instead of getting a bag of worms phenotypes, you actually see normal worms on the plate. And they find out, you know, where these mutations are. And it turns out, if they did this sort of suppression, if you mutate SET3, for example, you no longer see this phenotype. So this bag of worms phenotype requires SET3, right? Or SET4. So you need some sort of activation of the apoptotic pathway to see this bag of worm genotype. Okay, makes sense? Anybody got any questions on that? Good. Okay, so, you know, they did this, and I should throw in, it's also suppressed by SET9 gain of function. So they were able to put EGL1 into the pathway as well that I showed you before, the SET9 and SET3. And it turns out that EGL1 is really the initiator of apoptosis. That's why I got on my next slide here. All right, there you go. EGL1, so the way EGL1 works, it inhibits SED9. So when it's activated, it inhibits SED9 from inhibiting SED4. So when EGL1's activated, it promotes apoptosis by inhibiting the inhibitor. Turns out like EGL1 and its homologue in humans is like a major regulator for apoptosis. Okay. Then they had an idea, okay, so we see apoptosis. We know these cells undergo apoptosis. The idea is, you know, are they themselves dying or do they have like help? Like is it like a neighbor like in development telling them to die? So the question, you know, they had was, you know, was it kind of suicide? Like an apoptotic cell, if it goes through apoptosis, is it itself that's, you know, causing itself to die, or is it a neighbor telling it to die? So the idea is it's cell autonomous, you know, within its own inherent cell to kill itself, or is it cell non-autonomous? like a neighboring cell, is inducing these cells to go through apoptosis. Okay, so they wanted to figure out, you know, whether apoptosis was either cell autonomous or non-cell autonomous. And this is how they sort of did this experiment. And what they would do is they would create these transgenic worms. So creating transgenic worms turns out to be quite easy. So essentially you can make up any sort of plasmid. You know, you can make up a plasmid, any plasmid you want, you know, your double-stranded DNA, and inject it. So you essentially inject it. And we would inject it right, you know, our plasmid DNA right into the gonad here. That's what that region is. And this gonad kind of forms the cytoplasm of all the oocytes. So essentially you're putting in your plasmid into where your oocytes will take up its cytoplasm. So the oocytes will take up the plasmid itself. And essentially you're going to get the plasmids into the oocytes, and the oocytes become fertilized, and they get into the they're hatched, and the worms, their subsequent offspring, will have that plasmid. So if this plasmid can so the thing with C. elegans, this plasmid can survive what we call extrachromosomal. And that is, it doesn't have to incorporate itself into the chromosome. It can survive outside of the chromosome. And so that kind of really makes it easy for, you know, these cells would still have that plasmid, but it doesn't have to be incorporated into chromosomal DNA. It tends to be quite stable and transmits to like subsequent generations. Like, you know, the following generations will always have that plasmid as well. So it's an easy way to make transgenic worms to express, you know, proteins that we're interested in. Okay. All right, so for, you know, to find out whether it's cell autonomous, question, or cell non-autonomous, non-cell autonomous, they would make a specific sort of plasmid. So what they would do is they would have a plasmid that would have a promoter. It has this promoter here. And this promoter would be specific that it would only allow for expression in one cell type. And that cell type was the hermaphrodite-specific neuron. So a very specific promoter, you know, that had the DNA in the plasmid that only allows expression in the hermaphrodite-specific neuron. And then connected to that promoter, they have like the cDNA, and the cDNA would be for AGO1. And it would be for AGO1 gain of function. So essentially they make these transgenic worms that would express your AGO1 gain of function specifically in the HSN neuron and not in any other neighboring cell. And what they found was that in itself, so they put this in wild type worms, right? So you inject, you know, this plasmid, you create these transgenic worms, you know, like a wild type worm. What they're doing is expressing this AGO1 gain of function specifically in the one type of neuron, and they got the bag or AGO phenotype, the bag of worms phenotype. Okay, so what does that mean? What's that telling us? Yeah?
That only those neurons are responsible for the phenotype?
Exactly, so expression of this in here, in the HSN, was enough to cause that phenotype. You don't need that mutation in any other tissue to cause that phenotype. It's cell autonomous. So this is kind of like an important sort of experiment to demonstrate that is through the cell autonomous sort of process. So it's actually inherent within the cells for them to go through apoptosis. Okay. All right. Okay, a couple more points here. And that is, like, what happens to these cells? Like, you know, get back to what happens to these cells as they undergo apoptosis. One thing is, after they die, you know, the cell, the embryo needs a way to get rid of them. So they're removed. And so the final stage of cell death is actually through engulfment. So like a neighboring cell will actually remove that dead cell. And it turns out like a number, you know, if you look at it here, so these cells here, turns out like a neighboring cell right beside it would be involved in, you know, essentially eating it up, engulfing it. And it turns out there's always, it tends to be the twin or the cell that actually came up, that was actually part of the final cell division. So when this cell divided, this one would go through apoptosis. It's always its twin that is actually involved in engulfment. So if, you know, the twin would eat up that cell and remove these apoptotic cells. So it turned out to be quite interesting. Okay, so the thing is, it turned out that a number of the said genes were actually not defective in, you know, causing cell death, but they were defective in removing of these cells. So you can think of, like, you know, for example, you know, one mutation was like the SED10. So what happens is, like, they did this, you know, mutagenesis. They got loss of functions of SED10. So, you know, you remove its function, and they would have increase in the number of engulfment. Increase in the number of apoptotic cells. So, like, it's like really similar to what they saw with SED9. But, you know, it took a lot of work to determine that this wasn't involved in promoting cell death at all. It all was due to the fact that these apoptotic cells were not being removed. So it's due to the fact that these engulfment, they weren't able to remove these cells through engulfment. And it turns out that SED10 is really important for engulfing cells. And these orthologs, like SED10, is, you know, has orthologs in humans, are really important in mammalian phagocytosis. So, phagocytosis are these blood cells that are involved in, you know, specific blood cells involved in removing, like, foreign material, foreign cells, viruses, for example. These orthologs are very important for that sort of process in that function as well. So studying these engulfment genes was really useful for studying phagocytosis as well. Okay. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about the mammals in mammalian systems. And this is looking at, on the left here, we have like a normal mouse. And so this is doing reverse genetics, okay? This is reverse genetics. In this case, they knock out this gene called caspase-9. I just want to make sure I got this right. Yeah, caspase-9, this is actually its SED3 homologue. This is caspase-9. So it's important for, you know, for promoting apoptosis. And so with the mutation, when they knock out caspase-9, they see an absence of apoptosis. And can you kind of see what, like, the main, like, phenotype, like, what's the major issue here with this mouse on the right? What's its major problem here? What do you think? How would you describe it? Yeah?
Brain's too big.
Yeah, so exactly. So essentially, its number of neurons is you know, off the scale. And it's kind of bulging out of its skull, and it has like an oversized brain. And so that turns out to be quite important. So if you knock out, so unlike C. elegans, you know, apoptosis is required for the viability of mammals. You know, without this, we'd have like way, way too much brain structure, for example, and that would kill us. So too much neuronal tissue. And so what's really going on here? So this is like looking at some axons being formed, and axons going to their proper target. These are looking at specific, like, motor axons. So So what's on the left here, this is actually staining, like this is a whole mount of a mouse, and it's staining for one protein. The protein's called neurofilament. So this is actually a protein present in axons. You know, so it specifically lights up the axons. Really gets like a beautiful picture here. And then we're looking at, you know, how these axons, so this is still looking at, I guess this is still looking at how these axons migrate. And they're specifically looking at within the hind limb. And these are these motor axons, and what they have to do is like they innervate like the muscles within the leg. And the point here is that, so this is like a heterozygous for a frizzled. So do we know what's frizzled? What pathway is frizzled a part of? Do you remember? Do you guys take that in this course? No? Frizzled? No? Beta-catenin? Sorry, you want to say that? It's the Wnt pathway. Exactly. So this is a part of the Wnt pathway. And what happens here is that, so this is in the absence. So this is heterozygous. So these are like pretty well, they're normal, phenotypically normal. So you get the proper like axons, and these axons are allowed to make their synaptic connections to the muscles here. What happens here in the FRIZL3 mutant, the homozygous, is that these axons fail to migrate all the way into the muscle. So there's a failure to this migration, and what happens is that if you look at specifically the neurons, we find that there's a huge number of cell death in these neurons as well. So if they don't make their proper connections, so if the axons don't go properly into the muscles and form like a proper synapses, these neurons die. So that's what's, you know, maybe I'll go for the next example here. So, and this is kind of like another example here of what's going on. So we got like neurons from three different sorts of ganglion. You got like sympathetic neurons here on the left, dorsal root ganglion in the middle, and these taste or nodose ganglion on the right. And essentially you're looking at like how much they grow or survive in the presence of these growth factors. So the NGF here, I've got to make sure I always get my names on here. Yeah, so the NGF is the nerve growth factor. And this is a brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So just, I think this is interesting, the fact that if you treat the sympathetic neurons with NGF, you get a lot of growth. So they're really responsive to NGF and grow and don't go through apoptosis. The dorsal root is like somewhat responsive to it, but these sort of neurons within the taste ganglion, they're totally unresponsive to the NGFs, the neural growth factors. And you kind of see like a totally different thing with another factor, brain-derived neuronal factor. So that in the sympathetic cells, they don't respond. The dorsal root kind of respond, but the nodules, they really respond. Okay, so the point here is that these neurons respond to these growth factors. And the only way they get access to these growth factors is by making these synaptic connections. Okay? So they have to make these synaptic connections to allow for them to survive. And so like when we kind of go back here to like look at our mouse, what's really going on here is that, and this happens to us as well, is that we tend to make an excess amount of neurons during our development, a large number of neurons. And they are going out and they're trying to make their appropriate connections. And so we try to, you know, essentially like go overboard, make all these neurons, make as many connections as possible, and the ones that don't connect, don't make the synaptic connections, they are pruned away. They go through apoptosis and they are removed. That's like a very fundamental thing that's going on during brain development in mammals. So that's what's going on here. And kind of look examples of the same thing here and here. Okay. So the last thing, so as I mentioned, like these, you know, we talked about SED9 and SED3 and SED4. They do have these homologs in mammals, like they are essentially orthologs. These genes are very similar in terms of, you know, their sequence, and they carry out the same sort of function. I just want to point out a couple of things. So one thing is, you know, a lot of this stuff is done in C. elegans. And subsequently, a lot of stuff was done in mammals. And they found out one thing is that this kind of occurred in mammals, at least they found out, to occur on the mitochondria. So the mitochondria tends to play a very, very important role for apoptosis in mammals. You know, whether it's occurring in the worms, no one's really checked. But the point is that the mitochondria is a very important sensor for apoptosis, it turns out. Okay, so that's one thing I want to point out. Second thing is the SED9 homolog. The SED9 homolog in mammals is called BCL2. And BCL2 is like one of the most studied proteins, pharmaceutically anyways, because it tends to be very highly expressed in some tumors. So it tends to be turned on to promote survival within the tumors and unregulated cell growth. So a lot of work is done pharmaceutically to actually turn off BCL2 or the SED9 homolog. So that's a very fundamental area of research, basic research too, to help with cancer research. And then as I mentioned, SED3 has these caspases, these proteases, they're involved in promoting apoptosis. Okay, so, right. So it turns out that in our cells, we're all intrinsically capable, we're all programmed for cell death. So, you know, if we have, you know, something gone wrong, usually some sort of DNA damage, for example, some sort of mutations, that tends to activate the signals to essentially activate the AGL1 phenotype. So, you know, regulating this apoptosis plays a really important role in preventing cancer development, for one thing. You know, if there's something wrong with the cell should, you know, identify it, promote apoptosis, and prevent tumors from developing. So that's one way that apoptosis plays a really, really important role in preventing cancer development. Okay, all right, so just a quick recap. So I have a couple things I just want to point out. So apoptosis in C. elegans, and it's discovered due to three main ideas. One is through the invariant cell lineage, right? So without that, they would not have been able to identify those cells that were going through apoptosis. The fact that these apoptotic cells are visible, you know, you can look at it, they have that different reactivity, you can pick them out. And the good thing, with at least with the worms, is that the worms are viable even when you mutated them. So with mutations in the pathway, they still, to an extent, survived. And this is kind of a little bit different. This is not discovered due to, but apoptosis, at least in worms, is found to be cell autonomous. You know, it works in a cell autonomous manner. All right, I don't know. I think that's all I have. I'm not sure if you want to, you know, I have a couple movies if you're at all interested, if you're not interested, but I do have a couple movies on my laptop if you want to see, and I can explain that to you. I'm kind of bummed out I can't show it to you, all of you. But other than that, I'll just end it there. And thanks for listening. And best of luck. How are you guys hanging in for the strike? Not good. It's tough. Are you just making do? Yeah, that's too bad. Sorry, I'm sympathetic, but I can't really help. All right. Okay. Thanks very much.